This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Today through Labor Day, we're featuring interviews with soul singers, songwriters, session musicians, and producers. In 1957, singers Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield teamed up in Chicago to form the vocal group The Impressions. The group's first hit was the 1958 recording For Your Precious Love, featuring Butler singing lead. The following year, Butler left the group to start a solo career, going on to have such hits as He Will Break Your Heart, Moon River, Make It Easy on Yourself, Western Union Man, and Only the Strong Survive. Curtis Mayfield went on to become a star singer, songwriter, and producer. We'll hear an interview from the archive with the late Curtis Mayfield later in the show. I spoke with Jerry Butler last year after the publication of his memoir, Only the Strong Survive. He was born in rural Mississippi in 1939. 3 years later, he moved with his family to Chicago, where he still lives. In fact, he's now in politics, serving his fourth term on the Cook County Board of Commissioners. Let's start with some music.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy,
oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone. Oh, there's gonna be a whole lot of trouble in your life. So listen to me, get up off your knees, 'cause only the strong survive. That's what she said, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold on. Don't go.
Jerry Butler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Tell us the story behind this song.
Actually, this song and the lyrics were actual conversation that I had with my mother when I was about 16 years old. I was in love with an older woman, if you can believe that. And naturally, she said, this is a kid. I've got to move on with my life and do some other things. And so she just kind of dropped me like a hot potato. So I went, told Mama, hey, look, this is the end of the world. She said, boy, let me tell you this. That you have not seen half of the beautiful, lovely women in this world, and for you to be going through these kinds of changes this early in your life is absolutely ridiculous. Get out of here, you'll get over it. And Only the Strong Survive was really created out of that conversation. Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff were the co-writers on it, but the introduction that was recited was really from that conversation with my mother.
Now, you first sang gospel music. You were part of a group called the Northern Jubilee Singers, and Curtis Mayfield was in that group, too. And, of course, you also sang together in The Impressions. How did you first meet?
Curtis's grandmother, the Reverend Annabel Mayfield, was the pastor of this little congregation called the Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church. And Curtis's older cousins had this little group called the Northern Jubilee Singers. I wound up at this church one afternoon with a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Terry Williams, because we just had singing in common and loved to do it. And he said, I want you to meet these people and get to know them, and maybe you'll decide to get involved with the group. In fact, I did. We used to kick Curtis to the side because he was probably 9 years old. He was the little guy. You know, I was 13. I was an old man. And so we kind of kept shoving him to the back, until he learned how to play the guitar. And then he kind of just took over because he was the real musician out of the group.
Had your voice changed yet?
As a matter of fact, it had. My voice went into the baritone register when I was about 13, and it has never come up again.
What about Curtis Mayfield's? His couldn't have. He was only 9. How did he sound?
Well, you know, Curtis was just the opposite. Curtis always kind of sounded like a little girl, you know. You got to keep on pushing. Can't stop now. Move up a little higher. So he always had that kind of thing going. And I think over time, he effectively, as Smokey has done, used it to the point that it became really kind of his natural sound.
Now, did you and Curtis Mayfield leave gospel music for rhythm and blues at about the same time?
You know, see, we were never big and famous, as was Sam Cooke or Lou Rawls with the Pilgrim Travelers and Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers. We were basically a local group of kids attached to this one particular church. And even though on occasion we might wind up in the company of those great stars, we were never really known outside of the city of Chicago. And so when we started singing rhythm and blues, nobody was really affected by it, but maybe the people who belonged to the church and us. When Sam left, that was an uproar throughout the whole country in most of the churches, because here was this gospel icon that had gone from singing the sacred music to singing the secular music. And so there was a lot of, gnashing of teeth and carrying on about that. But Curtis and I, we really made and I would like to say we made an extension rather than a transition. Because even in Curtis's music, throughout the civil rights movement or what have you, you can still hear the strains of the gospel. And he really wrote kind of inspirational songs as opposed to what I call Hope to Die Love songs, which are the kind of things that I was writing.
What's an example of a Hope to Die Love song?
Your precious love means more to me than any love could ever be. Whereas he was writing, gotta keep on pushing. Can't stop now. Move up a little higher, you see?
Yeah, yeah.
A difference in attitude.
Well, I think it's time to hear your first hit. For Your Precious Love, which was recorded in 1958 when you were with the Impressions.
Yes.
And you say that this was, that the lyric was originally a poem that you wrote when you were in high school?
Yes, a poem called They Say, as a matter of fact. As you will hear it in the lyric.
Was it changed at all for the lyric, or is it exactly the same?
The only thing that was changed is the title, For Your Precious Love.
Okay, this is 1958, Jerry Butler and the Impressions. My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. That's his 1958 hit with the Impressions, For Your Precious Love. And he has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. Now, you recorded For Your Precious Love in your first recording session for VJ, and you also recorded that day Sweet Was the Wine, which was supposed to be the A-side.
Actually, we thought, when I say we, I thought, and most of the people who were in the room when For Your Precious Love was recorded felt that For Your Precious Love was a hit. But because it was such a ballad and so slow and so spiritual in feeling, the record company wanted to go with the other side, which was more up-tempo and danceable and supposedly more what teenagers were all about. But For Your Precious Love won out, and it was just one of those songs that teenagers as well as older people enjoyed, and it became the A-side.
Were there any squabbles about who would get to sing lead on your first recordings?
You know, it kind of came with the song. For instance, if Curtis wrote the song, Curtis sang the lead. If I wrote the song, I sang the lead. There was a squabble after For Your Precious Love was released, because Vivian Carter, who owned VJ Records and was the V in VJ Records, I should say, was also a disc jockey in Gary, Indiana, and she decided, having had an experience with a group called the Spaniels, where she wanted to take the lead singer and give him a career of his own, but he was so interwoven with the fabric of the Spaniels that she was afraid she would destroy the whole thing, made a promise to herself that the next time someone came through that door that had a unique sound and had a unique voice in it, that she was going to build that unique voice along with the group. So that in later years, if there was a breakup or if she decided to move one of the parts toward another career, she could take one act and make two. The Impressions happened to be that act, and Jerry Butler happened to be that voice. And so when the recording was released, it was released as Jerry Butler and the Impressions, and the group never recovered from it. We argued and fought about the billing from that day until the day I left, which was about 7 months, 8 months later.
Did that have to do with your leaving?
Yes.
Explain more about that.
Well, here we were, five young guys, walked into a recording studio as the Impressions, walked out as Jerry Butler and the Impressions. The other four guys were wondering, well, what did Jerry do to get top billing? How did all of a sudden it start to look as though we're working for him as opposed to him being just part of the group? When we got to the Apollo Theater in New York, they have Jerry Butler in great big letters, the Impressions in small letters. By the time we get to Miami, Florida, there's just Jerry Butler on the marquee, no Impressions at all. And in each one of those places, the other guys refused to perform because their feelings were hurt. Their pride was hurt. They just never could understand it. And no matter how much I told them that I hadn't done anything, that this was a decision that had been made by the record company, they just never bought it.
Did you realize yourself at the time how talented a singer and songwriter Curtis Mayfield was?
No. You know, Curtis was, when we first started, writing fairy tales. You know, Minstrel and Queen, Gypsy Woman, those kinds of little songs. And they were cute, but they, to me, did not show any out-of-sight kind of talent. About 1963, two or three, somewhere in there, he started to write the songs that, to me, were really Curtis Mayfield. He had matured to the point where he was writing We're Winner, Keep On Pushing, Say It's All Right, I'm So Proud of You. And then in the late 60s, he starts to do movie scores. Superfly, mm-hmm. and Let's Do It Again, and Claudine. And that was when, you know, my head started spinning around and I said, you know, this guy who I've treated as a younger brother most of his life and as a kid brother that is really a genius.
You wanted him to work as your backup guitarist when you went solo.
Yeah, actually, what happened was, when the group broke up, I got my share of whatever was left and started out on a solo career. I was performing in Washington, D.C., and my guitarist, who denies to this day that he did it, a fine guitarist by the name of Philip Upchurch, just quit. And he said, I'm leaving, I got a better gig, and I'm out of here. I was in a lurch. I didn't know what to do. I needed a musician to help me get through these performances. And so I called on my friend Curtis, and he responded. He said, you know, all I can play are the songs that I've written or the songs that we wrote together. And yeah, I'll do that. And so he flew out to Washington, and we started to work together. And out of that, we developed some songwriting skills between the two of us, and we started a publishing company called Curtom Music, which he later sold to Warner Brothers Music for a whole lot of money.
Now, you say in your memoir that when you were a, quote, lightweight celebrity, before you became very famous, that you still lived in the housing projects in Cabrini Green in Chicago.
Yes.
And you say you used to be able to ignore the pee in the elevators and the stairs, the wine bottles and junkies. You'd been surrounded by that kind of filth most of your life. But then it became too much to bear. What changed that made that filth too much to bear?
You know, you become oftentimes a product of your environment. Once you have something else to compare it to, then it's difficult. You know, it's like, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
Mm-hmm.
You know, suddenly we were moving around. We were being treated as celebrities. We were eating in restaurants. We were going and living in hotels where the rooms were spick and span and the beds were made up perfectly and there was no smell of urine around. And suddenly we realized that it was within our reach to get out, to be part of a bigger and better world. And what I am hoping that the book will do. And as I go around talking to a lot of young people who are still living in those kinds of conditions, that you can get out. You have to work. You have to compete. But you can get out.
My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with singer Jerry Butler. Let me get to another hit you had, Moon River, which is the Henry Mancini song, the title song from the movie of the same name. This is a much more, I mean, Andy Williams also had a hit of this, and his hit was a very, like, middle-of-the-road kind of recording. Did you consider this a different direction for you musically?
Well, if allow me to make one small correction in your statement, first of all.
Yeah.
The movie was entitled Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Of course, right,
and
yes.
And not Moon River.
Yes.
But the song was sang in the movie by Audrey Hepburn, sitting on a windowsill with an acoustical guitar. Henry Mancini and Johnny Mercer were the writer, and they wanted to get as many people to record this song as possible because they were sure that it was going to at least be nominated, if not win, the Academy Award. Nobody wanted to record the song. First of all, it was a waltz. Second of all, it was Moon River. Well, where is Moon River, and what is that all about? Calvin Carter, who was the brother of Vivian Carter, who owned VJ Records, said, and was the A&R man for the company, said, Jerry, this is going to be an important song for your career. Sing this song. Curtis and I took the song, and we hated it in three-quarter time, so we put it in 4/4 time. Well, when we got to the studio singing it in four, it was about 4 minutes, 15 seconds long, which was far too long for airplay in that period of time. And so we had to speed it up. In speeding up the tempo, we got into a slight cha-cha, bossa nova kind of rhythm, and that gave it a different edge. So we added a guitar to give it that country western flavor and a harmonica. And then we just draped all these violins and strings around it to give it New York sophistication, because that's really what the whole deal was about, was that there was this pretty young girl who was from some rural area who had come to the big city, and she was dealing with this concept of a Moon River wider than a mile. She was going to cross it in style. She was going to be somebody. She was going to do all these wonderful things. And so we had the first vocal recording of Moon River. Mancini and Mercer believed that I should have sang it on the Academy Awards show. The problem was that CBS, which was the company that Columbia Records was owned by, was also planning to give Andy Williams a television show, and they needed a theme song for his show. And he had recorded this Breakfast at Tiffany's album, and Moon River was going to be that song. Moon River got the Academy Award. Andy Williams sang it, and it became the theme song for a show.
You feel kind of cheated by that?
You know, I think when it first happened, I did. But if I had sang Moon River on the Academy Awards show, my life probably would have been a lot different than the life I've had, which has been pretty good.
Okay. Let's hear 1961 Jerry Butler's recording of Moon River. Our interview with Jerry Butler was recorded last year after the publication of his autobiography, Only the Strong Survive. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with singer Jerry Butler. He co-founded The Impressions with Curtis Mayfield in 1957 and sang lead on their hit For Your Precious Love. Then Butler went solo, recording such hits as He Will Break Your Heart, Moon River, Western Union Man, and Only the Strong Survive. In 1962, he had a hit recording of the Burt Bacharach Hal David song, Make It Easy on Yourself. I asked Butler how he got to work with Bacharach.
Burt had recorded Make It Easy on Yourself as a demonstration record with Dionne Warwick, who was really his voice. And they took this record to SEPTA Records. Florence Greenberg at that time was the president, owner of the company. She fell in love with Dionne's voice, but she didn't like Make It Easy on Yourself. And so Burt was kind of stuck with this big production on this song and no place to go with it. He used it as a demonstration record and sent it to Calvin Carter out here in Chicago. And Calvin said, Jerry, this is a good song. We ought to record this song. And I said, okay, who are we going to get to arrange it? He said, I like the way this guy arranged the song. And so we're going to use him. And we went back to New York, and we hired Burt to do the arrangement. And that's how Make It Easy on Yourself came about.
Did you learn anything musically from working with Bacharach, or learn anything about singing this particular song? Did he give you any advice about this particular song?
You know, Bert and I were kind of at odds. Bert was a very strict musician in the sense that, and especially with his songs, because most of these songs were new, had never been heard before, and he wanted to make sure that the melody was precise and that the rhythm was precise. That's why I said he used Dionne the way he used her, because Dionne was like an instrument for Burt. Do you know the way to San Jose? Dot, 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 dot. You know, very structured. She could have been a trumpet.
I know exactly what you mean.
Okay. I had a tendency to lay back. Oh, breaking up is so very hard to do. Ba-ya-do-dee-da-da. Because I wanted people to hear my phrasing. Burt wanted people to hear his song. And so we argued a lot about, well, you came in late. And I said, but that's where I felt it. It doesn't fit.
So you kind of won on that one, don't you think?
Well, you know, I kind of had a lot going in my favor. I was, quote, unquote, the star. He was a fledgling arranger, just getting started. And the record company was paying the bill. And so, which meant eventually I was going to pay the bill because they were going to charge all of this stuff back to me.
Right.
But we did, in fact, work as well as we could together and became good friends. But I never had another hit with any of his songs, whereas Dionne had several.
Do you feel like you did what you wanted to do with Make It Easy on Yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, after I recorded it, it became what was known in the industry as a turntable hit. Got lots of airplay, and we sold maybe 250,000 half million records or so. Later, a group from England called the Walker Brothers re-recorded it pretty much the same way that I had done it. And then, to show how what goes around comes around, in the early 70s, Dion re-records a song that I had learned from her demonstration record and had a big hit with it herself.
It's been so much fun to talk with you. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jerry Butler recorded last year after the publication of his memoir, Only the Strong Survive. Let's hear his recording, Make It Easy on Yourself.
So very hard to do. If you really love him, then there's nothing I can do. Don't try to spare my feelings, just tell me that we're through. And make it easy on yourself. Make it easy on yourself. Cause breaking up is so very hard to do.
This is Fresh Air.